Mr. Packer, you've been
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
I'm guilty of the murder of Emma Caldwell and a large number of other very serious crimes. Over more than 25 years, you pursued a campaign of violence and appalling sexual mistreatment of a very large number of women. The women involved resisted and protested, but you would not listen. The trauma you caused has led to suffering which has endured for decades, but the courage and perseverance shown by so many women is truly heart-lifting. They testified out of solidarity for all of the other women you abused, to protect other women in the community, and in the hope that justice would be done. This jury listened, and they heard them loud and clear.
Now, that was the judge delivering the verdict in the case of the murder of a young woman, Emma Caldwell. The accused was a man called Ian Packer, who murdered Emma violently in remote woods about an hour outside Glasgow. It was justice delivered only earlier this year, 19 years after the original crime was committed by Packer. Sam Poling, a BAFTA award-winning BBC journalist, began investigating the crime for her podcast, Who Killed Emma? And during the course of her investigations, she met Stuart Hall, a now retired former detective. As it turns out, Stuart had actually solved the crime just 5 weeks after the murder took place in 2005, but he was ignored by his superiors. Sam Poling and Stuart Hall both join me now, and a warning that some of what you're about to hear, you may find a bit disturbing. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
Can we start with you, Sam, to tell us a little bit about the background to Emma and the time of her disappearance?
So you need to turn the clock back to 2005, and Emma Caldwell was working on the streets of Glasgow. She was a sex worker. She'd turned to sex work to fund an addiction to heroin. She'd turned to drugs after the death of her sister from cancer. And in the depths of her grief, she had turned to drugs, and to fund that habit, she had become a prostitute on the streets of Glasgow. April 2005, Emma goes missing. Now, she was the eighth woman to have been murdered on the streets of Glasgow. So when she went missing in 2005 in the April, the police threw everything at this case. It was a Category A case really from the off, because it was very unusual behaviour. And 5 weeks later, her body was found in a remote wood about an hour's drive from Glasgow. She was naked. She had been strangled, and immediately a Category A police investigation, which is the highest resource police investigation, started looking into who had killed Emma Caldwell. And it was a massive investigation. It's one of the biggest murder investigations that any police force in Scotland had ever undertaken. And very quickly on, they identified a number of suspects, and they were four Turkish men that they started to focus their attention on, who they believed had killed Emma.
Now, the place in where she plied her trade was called the Drag. What sort of a place was that? Was it known to be a dangerous place for the prostitutes?
It was. I mean, at night time in Glasgow, Glasgow would empty at a certain time of night. So the streets would be very, very quiet. And the Drag was this almost like a Glasgow's laid out in a grid. And the Drag would be this kind of big rectangle where the drivers, the men, would be able to drive round and round looking for the women. The women would know to stand on the corners of these really quiet streets at the traffic lights, which would give reason, you know, an excuse for the men to stop if they were ever asked by the police, why you stopped here? I'm at the traffic lights, but it was to pick up the women. And just off the main Drag area would be lots of little dark alleys, and that's where a lot of the trade would take place. And industrial estates were literally, you know, scattered around the city as well, very small car parks and industrial estates. And so it was known, you know, everybody knew where the red light area was. And I hate using the term red light area, because I think people think of this brightly lit, you know, shop front selling sex type thing in Amsterdam. It's not that. This was dark, it was dingy, it was gritty, it was horrible, it was violent. I mean, the women faced violence on a daily, nightly basis here.
Now, we use the term prostitutes because some of the contemporaries of Emma use that term about themselves and what they did at that time.
Yeah, I was very conscious when I started looking into the case, and I spoke to so many of the women and said, look, How do you like to be referred to in terms of what you do? And they didn't like the term sex worker. They didn't like many of the terms. What they said was it's prostitution. We are prostitutes. That's what we do. That's what we would like you to call us. So I often use the term. Some people get very offended by it. And as one of the women said to me, it's always those who've never done it who get offended the most. But yes, that's what they asked to be referred to.
Emma's own personal story is so heartbreaking that she was a normal young girl who liked to do all the things that teenagers do. And she was particularly into horse riding. That was one of her passions. And it was only when tragedy visited her family that she went off the rails.
Yeah, Emma came from a really normal family. And what do we mean by that? I don't know. But, you know, she had a really loving, close, tight-knit family. They grew up not wanting for anything. She loved horses. She used to go horse riding. She worked at a stables. She had a brother and a sister. And then her sister was diagnosed with cancer. And it was her big sister. And they were very close. And when her big sister died, Emma was just broken by this. She was lost. And at the stables, somebody said to her one day, and it was a boyfriend, said, look, I can give you something to help you with the pain of your grief. And that was heroin. And that was it. I mean, she was addicted very, very quickly. She moved up to Glasgow to be with the boyfriend. The relationship didn't last. And so she was left alone, but with an addiction that she needed to feed. And that started the course of her life. And ultimately her death.
And she hadn't been entirely lost. She kept in touch with her mother and her father. Her father used to go visit her, pick up her laundry, bring it home and then bring back fresh stuff. So although she was a prostitute and she was a drug addict, she was not entirely lost.
No, she kept in contact with her family. She spoke to her mother every single night on the phone. They didn't know what she did for a living. So she would phone them up and, hey, Mum, how are you? They'd have a chat and then she'd say, I'm off to bed now. Good night, Mum. Put the phone down, get ready and go off to work for the night, right through to the early hours. They never knew until the day that they were told Emma was had gone missing, that they found out what she had done for a living. And I remember her dad's reaction was that his daughter, you know, Emma, it was typical of Emma to do something that only ever harmed herself. She didn't go out shoplifting. She didn't go out robbing. She only did something that harmed herself. And he said that was the nature of his daughter.
Now, Sam has been talking about the dangers to the women at that time, Stuart. What was the attitude of the police of the day to the kind of violence that was being visited upon these women, and when they reported it, what reaction they might get?
Well, I was a detective, was in an area called Dumbarton, which was about 20 miles outside the city centre. So I had no personal experience of working in the red light area, working with the girls who were involved in prostitution. During the trial, certain stories came out about the police attitude towards the prostitutes in the area. You know, they wouldn't perhaps take some of their complaints seriously. They wouldn't follow up on them. I'm perhaps not best qualified to have an oversight of the police attitude towards the working girls because it wasn't an area that I worked in. This was my first murder inquiry and my first city centre inquiry.
Now, it turned out, with the wisdom of hindsight, that you cracked the case very quickly.
Yes, the way that worked out, I spoke to one of the prostitutes who had worked with Emma, and she described a man with a van with writing on the side who had raped Emma sometime before the murder. And within a day or two of being on that inquiry, someone else matching the description of that male and a similar sounding van was stopped in the city centre. I followed up on that, and which led to Ian Packer coming into the police office for the first of my three interviews with him.
So this man has subsequently, of course, been convicted not just of the murder and the rape of Emma Caldwell, but also of multiple other charges. And you had, as a detective, you had this man in your sights at the time. What happened that it wasn't progressed at that time and it took 19 years before a conviction resulted?
Well, there's the question. That's something I've been living with for all those times. The inquiry had been running for about 6 or 7 weeks before I was drafted on to work on it. I had Ian Packer into the office on my second day on the inquiry. And when I first met Ian Packer, I got the feeling immediately that it was him. He was guilty. He would be guilty. He was the murderer. For at least over a year while I was on that inquiry, I continued to progress the Ian Packer side of the inquiry. I spoke to more prostitutes. I gathered evidence, and the evidence kept building. However, there seemed to be a lack of interest in my line of inquiry. They seemed more focused on the four Turkish men, which they had been looking at before I went on the inquiry.
Now, Sam, you can explain how the four Turkish men came into the frame and the cafe they used to inhabit, and which was also a place where the prostitutes would go or be brought.
Within a very short amount of time of Emma going missing, the police realised that the last phone call made to Emma's phone was made by a Turkish man. And that Turkish man had been a client of Emma's only on one occasion, apparently. But that led them to think, OK, well, he was the last man to have contact with Emma while she was alive on the night she goes missing. They then start to talk to a number of prostitutes who say, well, we don't know anything about Emma and her murder, but we get taken to a cafe at night. And when we're there, there's lots of men. We are sexually abused, we're assaulted, and we are often raped. And when the police look into this cafe, by coincidence, it's a Turkish cafe. So they now have this picture being built up of a number of Turkish men who are associating with prostitutes, where there are levels of violence being used against the women and sexual assault. They then discover that Emma had also been going to this cafe. So they start looking closely at this cafe. They bug the cafe. Listening devices, they bug it with cameras, they bug the cars and the homes of these Turkish men in the hope that they are going to gather the evidence against all these men for the murder of Emma Caldwell. And after 2 years, that's exactly what happens. They get enough evidence together, they believe, which leads to four Turkish men being arrested and charged with Emma's murder. And they're arrested and charged in the August. And by the December, all four men are released because the evidence that the police have gathered is just not going to stack up in court. The evidence they'd gathered was wrong.
And therefore, the Turkish element of this case completely collapsed. And it has to be said that there was nothing to it, as it turned out, because we know that Ian Packer was the man in question. So when did you start to become curious about the case of the missing and murdered Emma Caldwell and begin your podcast investigations?
Out of the blue, in 2018, I receive a letter, and we don't get letters nowadays. And I remember getting this letter with a stamp on it and handwritten letter and opening it and seeing a letter from a man called Ian Packer. And I vaguely knew the name because I knew a number of men had been spoken to by the police years earlier in the investigation into the murder of Emma Caldwell. And his letter basically said, I was spoken to by the police, I didn't kill her, and I kind of would like to know what information the police have and I'd like your help. I arranged to meet with Ian Packer, and that was early 2018, and I met with him many times during the rest of that year. And he tells me, I didn't do this. I didn't kill Emma. I'm not a violent man. I was spoken to by the police, yes, because I used prostitutes, but so did hundreds of other men. And I say to him, well, I'm going to investigate this case, and would you do an interview? And I'll go away and investigate, and then you can come back for a second interview and I can tell you what I've got. And he agrees. And I set off on this investigation, actually thinking, well, maybe no smoke without fire, maybe it is the Turkish men. And as the months go on, I slowly start to gather my evidence. I realise that the man I'm hunting, the killer of Emma Caldwell, is the man I've been meeting all this time, and it's Ian Packer. And he's been sitting lying to me this whole time. And not only has he killed Emma, he had assaulted, sexually assaulted, abducted and raped multiple women for years.
And it's fair to say that your investigation for the podcast became a template which then the police were going to follow.
Well, yeah, so I got him in for the interview, interviewed him. We broadcast and then confronted him with the evidence on the second interview to say, hey, you've been lying to us. You killed Emma. You're a rapist. And this is what you've done. And we broadcast that interview, and the police came knocking and they wanted our evidence. And a number of women started to come forward as a result of our investigation and as a result of the podcast. And Ian Packer was then arrested for multiple rapes, multiple sexual assaults, and for the murder of Emma Caldwell. And when it came to trial, the interviews that we did with Ian Packer and the investigation that we did was used as key evidence against him. In court, the interviews were played. I gave evidence towards the very end of the trial. And at the very end, you know, the judge singled out a few people. And one of those was Stuart Hall, the police officer who had solved it in the early days. I mean, this, you know, I didn't solve the case. The case was solved. It was solved back in the early days within 5 weeks of Emma going missing and being found.
Now, Stuart,
it was just that the police were not believed.
Stuart, you, as you mentioned, you were involved in the early days of this case and all the direction pointed at Ian Packer. You were initially reluctant to talk to Sam when she was trying to contact you, but you decided, I've got to do this. I've lived with this for far too long. I've got to talk.
Yes, I had watched the documentary and I'd listened to some of the podcast. While I was still serving with the police, I had basically, after this case, I had given up on my career. The police asked me, or told me, took me off the inquiry, and I gave up. I gave up on promotions and things like that. And I tried to basically forget about the inquiry for the rest of my time in the police and sort of try and move on with my life. However, after watching the documentary and listening to the podcast, it became apparent to me that there was a large section of the story missing. And I thought that Sam should hear it from the horse's mouth. I hadn't been mentioned. The Packers side of the whole inquiry had been buried. And I wanted people to know. I wanted my story, the truth, to be heard. So that's why I contacted Sam. I think I had retired about a year and a half earlier. I thought, well, this is my opportunity to get the story, get the proper story out there.
Now, the extraordinary thing was that all the evidence that was needed to convict him, you know, much of it was provided by Emma's contemporaries at the time, their accounts of encounters with Packer, and the defence tried to portray them as self-serving in some way, that they wanted to, a touch of celebrity to attach to their names, although I can't really see why, but the defence really fell apart. But there were key things, forensic evidence, if you like, that still remained. For example, the item that was used to strangle Emma was conclusive evidence, really, of Packer's guilt.
Yes. To give you some background to that, for 10 years before I joined the police, I was a neon draftsman. I don't think it's a job that exists anymore. So I was a sign designer, designed Perspex signs and neon signs. And in the manufacture of neon signs, there's wiring involved which connects the neon tubes. And that wiring gets burnt at the ends because there's a high voltage goes through. And once Ian Packer had come into the inquiry, the first day they discovered his van said Alpha Beta signs on it. And I just made a connection with a sign van and a burnt cable. It wasn't the correct cable. It was a twin-core speaker cable. You know, the thing is like in a transparent pink plastic mm-hmm. sleeve. As you perhaps know yourself, speaker cable
sure,
wouldn't
yeah.
get burnt at the ends in the proper course of its business. So this charred cable stuck in my mind, and I thought there could be a connection here between someone using this cable inappropriately, which would then get burnt at the ends. And that, to me, was a connection.
Now, Sam, you confronted Ian Packer with his lies to you. What was that like? Because you had a situation where this man had been glib with you and was trying his best to be charming, introducing you to his girlfriend, bringing you back even a souvenir from Disney in Florida as a gift. And then you realise you've been talking to the murderer of Emma Caldwell all along?
All the evidence that I've seen and everything that I have learned makes it clear that you are a sexually violent man.
Not sexually violent man whatsoever.
You have raped women.
I've never raped any in my life.
And all the evidence that I've seen means that I think you've got a very few hard questions to answer about the death of Emma Caldwell.
Not at all. I know nothing about it.
And it makes you the prime suspect.
So I'm a prime suspect now, am I?
Did you kill Emma?
No, I never. I could look you in the eye and say no, I had nothing to do with it whatsoever.
Yeah, I remember on Christmas Day, he sends me a text saying, Merry Christmas, sweetie, I hope you get all you wish for. And I was sitting there thinking, I know you killed Emma. I know what you've done, and I'm having to maintain this facade of pleasantry between us. And he flies back from his holiday. We arrange for him to do the second interview. He's excited by this interview. He thinks that I'm going to sit him down and say, ta-da, I've got evidence it was the Turkish men. He has no idea what I have. And he gives me this gift from his holiday and he gives me a hug and a kiss, and he's all excited. And I say to him, are you ready? And he says to me, I'm excited. I can't wait to hear what you found out. And I remember walking up these three flights of steps to the filming location thinking this is going to be a moment. And he sits down, and the very first thing I say to him is, I don't believe you've been telling me the truth. And you can see his face. I mean, the colour goes, and you can hear his breathing change. And he says, what do you mean? And I basically then just throw these allegations at him. You've attacked women. You strangled this one. You've raped that one. You raped Emma. And I think you killed Emma. And it was like the oxygen had been, sucked out of the room. He is white. He is struggling to get his breath. But he won't leave. He just sits there the whole time. And I will never forget that towards the end of that, I think the whole confrontation is about 11 minutes long, and you can hear it in the episode of the podcast. And at one point, he leans forward and he says to me, and this is after I've accused him of being a rapist and a murderer, and he leans forward and he says, does this mean we'll no longer be in touch? And I think that was the measure of the man. This was a man, he didn't care. This all he was worried about at that moment was that was our friendship finished, because he thought it was a friendship. Yeah.
Now, the result of this was ultimately a trial and multiple charges and a conviction and a sentence that he would serve life, but a minimum of 36 years, mm-hmm. which means he dies behind bars. But the unanswered questions you've been asking yourselves, both you and Stuart, Sam, is about the women who suffered at his hands in the intervening 19 years from the disappearance and murder of Emma to his conviction.
Yeah, look, these women spent years not being believed, not being heard, not being seen. There was no such thing as rape of a prostitute. The police officers would tell them that at the time. They have been treated that way ever since. They say they lost absolute trust in the police. And for them to come together to give their evidence and their testimony as bravely as they did. The sad thing about all of this, Pat, is that a number of the women who were raped and attacked by Ian Packer haven't survived. You know, they weren't there to give evidence. So like Stuart Hall was, I think, recalled 5 or 6 times during that trial to give evidence on behalf of women who were no longer here, that died in the process. But to watch the bravery and strength of these women to give their evidence was really quite something.
Finally, you know, it's not over because there are inquiries as to why this happened. I mean, millions and millions and millions of pounds were spent on the inquiry, an exhaustive investigation, it would appear. And yet what was in front of their eyes was overlooked. And the question is why and who's responsible?
Yeah, given this a lot of thought, a couple of different theories. However, they may just have gone down a line that they had spent so many man hours, so much money on, that they had reached a point of no return. They had to keep going with it and trying to see if they could make it fit, which is how it looked to me. I've never understood why they wouldn't listen. Initially, they did, but they returned to the Turks when the second part of the operation, when Operation Guard came on board. The initial inquiry was called Operation Grail. Operation Guard came on board to solely look at the Turks. In my mind, it never was the Turks. There was never any evidence against the Turks. I couldn't understand why the police proceeded the way they did.
An apology was ultimately forthcoming from Police Scotland, I believe. But, you know, to what end, really, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, 19 years it's taken for the women to get that apology. You know, it didn't mean anything to them. It was nice for them to hear, they've told me. But there will be a public inquiry in the next few years, which I think will answer a lot of questions that we're all still left with. I know Stuart Hall and his colleagues, who said it was Ian Packer from the start, have a lot of questions. I have a lot of questions. And we know, you know, one of the crucial things that we must never forget is that a number of these victims became victims after Emma's murder. Had the police been believed, the initial officers, then Ian Packer would have been arrested, he'd have been charged, and he would have been taken off the streets. Instead, he went on for the next X years to rape, to assault, to abduct women.
And bringing women, this is the extraordinary thing, bringing women to the very site where Emma's body was found.
Yeah, he was, I mean, a number of the assaults and rapes and abductions that he was charged with took place after Emma's murder. So this is a man who's taken a woman to one of the remote locations that you could take somebody to, an hour's drive from Glasgow, murders Emma, gets away with it, and then in the years afterwards continues to take women there. It's extraordinary to think that. And it's extraordinary to know that had the police done their job in the first place and listened to the officers on the ground, those victims would never have been victims. Those women would never have suffered at the hands of Ian Packer in the way they did.
In spite of the delays, in spite of the evil that occurred after the death of Emma Caldwell, you must get some satisfaction to see justice ultimately done on foot of the work that you did, Sam, and the work that you had done, Stuart.
I am glad that justice has been done. I'm glad that Ian Packer has been put on trial. I'm glad he was convicted. I'm glad that he is serving. I mean, it's one of the longest sentences handed out to a single person for a single person murder in Scotland, 36 years minimum. So I am glad that he is no longer a danger. I think from a journalist's point of view, we always say it's not our job to catch a killer. It's our job to ask why haven't the police? And in this case, I think, you know, we did help catch the killer. I think the questions that we're asking is, why did it take so long? Why did it take 19 years? And why is it that we have officers like Stuart Hall who 19 years later, you know, are still having to tell their story, having not been believed all this time, and only now they're suddenly being believed?
And to you, Stuart, has it vanquished some of those ghosts that haunted you since then?
No. In a word, I'm still living with this. It was good in court, finally to be vindicated, to be listened to, and the judge's summing up, he showed appreciation for the work that I had done back in 2005, and that was nice to hear. That helps. But I didn't come out of the trial feeling happy about it for the same reasons as Sam. You know, I'm glad the family get the conviction, if that helps them. Packers away, can't harm anyone else, and if all the other prostitutes get something from that. My anger was more towards the police, not Packer. Packer, to me, was a murderer who lied to me on interview. But the police kept this going for decades longer than it had to, and I've lived with that. So it's not about me, but a lot of the pain's still there.
Well, it is indeed a salutary tale. I've been listening to the podcast Who Killed Emma? It's a BBC podcast, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts. You can get it on Spotify or whatever. But my thanks to Sam Poling, the BBC investigative journalist and host of Who Killed Emma, and to Stuart Hall, former detective at Police Scotland. Thank you both very much for joining us on our programme.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
And if you're affected by anything in that IP item, you can contact the Rape Crisis Centre 24-hour hotline on 1-800-77-8888.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.